Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the Habibis. Three Arab developers drinking good Arab tea. No, I messed up the intro. Oh, crap. Oh, no. It's been a while since I messed up an intro, though, right?
Yeah, it's usually the outros. But, yes.
I'm your host for this week, Osama Dorias.
And I'm your co-host, Fawzi Mesmar.
And we don't have a Rabbi today because he is busy. He is otherwise indisposed. So yeah. At least he doesn't get to hear me messing up the intro. Wait, Fozzy, if I mess up the intro, does that mean that I'm not going to mess up the outro? Is that how it works?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. But oh, time will tell.
You could have encouraged me.
You would can have believed do it. You can All do right. it. I believe in you. Do you believe me now?
No. I believe in me. I believe in you who believes in me. Does that work?
It works.
Yes. Have you been, Fawzi?
I've been okay, man. I'm pretty good.
Have you done anything amazing this past week?
I don't know if it's amazing. I'm visiting Serbia for the first time. That's amazing. It's my first time.
That is amazing. Absolutely amazing. I've never been. How was it?
It's my first time over here, man. I'm loving it. People are awesome. Lots of history around everywhere in the city. I've only been here a couple of days so far, but I mean, I'm digging it. I'm not going to stay here for too long. I'm here for like 4 or 5 days because I'm speaking at a conference. But while I'm here, I'm taking the time to visit some of the local developers. Nice. And that's been super nice. There was this team. Last time I met them, I met them in Warsaw, in Poland. Mm-hmm. I was a Google mentor. So like I was at this Google event to like support like really small teams. And when I met them, they were just 10 people and they were starting out to make their first game. And I sat down with them and I gave them some advice on their game and stuff like that. That's 2019. So it's been a while now.
Yeah.
4 years. So I checked in on them the other day. They're like now a team of over 80.
Wow.
It's super cool, man. So I got to see, like, in over those 4 years, the company has really grown. I met, like, with the leadership team over there. They kept, when I sat with them for those 15 minutes in 2019 or something like that, I forgot what they asked me. Like, I really don't remember. But at the time, I took a piece of paper and I just drew something on it to explain my point.
Yeah.
And they still have that piece of paper.
Wow. So
I was like,
that's
wow.
That's incredible.
That's amazing.
So apparently, you have a huge impact on people, Fawzi. That's
apparently
amazing.
Some of the stuff I mentioned to them during the time that we met resonated quite a bit for them and their business. So I was really happy.
I'm very happy too. You know what's wild? You said 2019. And I'm like, oh, last year. I just like since the pandemic, it's like, I don't understand time anymore. Yeah, 2019 is 4 years ago. That is wild.
Yeah,
and
that's
in that
the thing.
Time, they grew so much and they accomplished so much. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. It's hard. It's hard to think that 2019 was 4 years ago. But
yeah, that makes
but
no sense.
It is the same. So yeah, so it's been pretty cool. I took some time, visit them at the new office, kind of like saw everybody, and. But because they're still like an indie development team, so like I don't think they can afford to come to the conference that I'm speaking at. So I was like, okay, well, since I'm here, I'll just do the talk just for you guys.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fawzi, when are you going to do the talk for me? I've been waiting to hear this specific talk since you mentioned your it's the same subject as your book, right?
Yeah, so that so it's kind of like a subsection now. I also like I'm doing this new talk about creating memorable moments in video games.
Oh,
so it's
cool.
Basically is like studying the psychology of what makes a moment memorable, and then trying to apply that to video games.
Mm. That's incredible. I remember having this conversation a long time ago with a friend. And I'm not throwing shade on any games or any studios, by the way. This is my disclaimer.
But throw shade.
No. Absolutely not. But like, you'll understand why I give that disclaimer. So a friend of mine said that his favorite games were the Uncharted series. And that's totally okay. They're very well-crafted games. And I asked, what do you like about them? He's like, well, the story. And then I said, oh, okay, what's the story about? And he just kind of fumbled through a whole bunch of key memorable moments that happened in the game and none of the plot that happened between it. It's like you do this, and then this happens, and this bit, like you're hanging off a train, and another one is like, and then a helicopter comes, and it like blows the bottom floor of your building, and the whole thing, like everything that he mentioned wasn't traditional like plot points. They were just moments, like really, really wild moments that were very, very, very memorable. And later on, as I started learning that that's how Naughty Dog designs their games, they start off with what are these memorable moments that we could create, and now let's like weave a tale around them. What kind of story can we tell with them?
Makes a lot of sense.
It makes sense for that type of game, right? Like each game has a different like what are you trying to do? What are you trying to make the player feel? And in their case, it is the wow moments. That is where their gold is.
I think like that's kind of what I'm like, you know, advocating for in this talk that I'm looking at, is that if you were able to analyze and understand what makes a moment defining or memorable, then you can deliberately create one.
Yes.
So you can like deliberately create all of these circumstances that make that moment defining or memorable.
Yes. As I mentioned, I'm working on my board game, and one of the things that you do when you work on board games is you playtest a lot. And I've had the privilege of playtesting with Nate Hayes, who actually used to work at Wizards of the Coast on Magic the Gathering for a very, very long time. He's a published board game designer as well. He made like the Gargoyles board game and a whole bunch of other board games. So he's extremely experienced. And what his advice generally when he played my game was, do you see these? If you make these small tweaks, these become amazing setups for stories that players can tell, like memorable moments about these interactions. If you make these tweaks, and the tweaks are always basically his philosophy came down to, and I'm giving away his secrets on a podcast. Oh no. His philosophy came down to balance isn't as important as designers think it is. Everyone's always trying to balance a game as much as possible. He's like, it's important, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that you set up your game so that you could have these story moments, which is what he called them, which is another way of saying these memorable moments. They're the moments that when the game is over, people will tell a story about that specific game. And then I did this and I did this. And then I was able to play this interaction a million times and do this. Like that kind of story sticks with people. And he's like, the more you can make your game have those moments, the happier players will feel, the more memorable it'll be in their mind. So that was, you know,
absolutely. Really, that was cool. It seems like, you know, a lot of us thinking around the similar things. I guess, like, you know, what I'm also like, what I was looking into is that when we recall moments, it's similar to like that friend that you described, is that when we recall an experience, our recollection is selective. That means that we don't recall all the events similarly or equally at the same time. We tend to remember the highest highs, the lowest lows, and the moments of transition the most.
Yes.
And the ending. Which is also a transition in its own right. That's why it's called the peak end phenomenon. It means is that we only remember all the high parts and the ending a lot of the times. That's why if a game starts off really strong but ends off really bad, most people would remember it as negatively.
Yes.
Regardless of the positive high ends that we have in it.
It's actually the same philosophy that, like, I did stand-up comedy for a while. I wasn't very good at it, but I tried it.
Funny.
Yeah, years and years ago. I mean, not like professionally, just open mic nights, that kind of thing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and one of the lessons that I learned at the time from people who were doing it before me is always start your routine with your second best joke and end with your best joke. Mm-hmm. And then people will think that they had a good time throughout. And that stuck with me forever. That's kind of why when I give my presentations, I always start with a joke and end with a joke. Like, you know, like famously or infamously, depending on how you think of it, the hosting of the Game Awards started with a knock knock joke.
Definitely infamously.
depending. But yeah, 99% of people will
depending
agree
on everyone.
Except me. I'm the only one who doesn't agree, but it's fine. That's what I'm thinking. You make it punchy and it becomes memorable as a result. So I think, there's a lot of convergence on this thought, but to be quite honest, up until recently, I haven't really heard it be articulated. So I think that you're doing a big service to collect these thoughts and these findings and sharing it broadly with our industry. Thank you, Fozzie.
Yeah, of course, man. It's my pleasure. And I hope that, well, it seems like it. Like I've gotten a lot of messages from the team the days after I did the talk, and it seems like it resonated well with them. So I'm pretty excited about that and looking forward to doing the talk at the conference in the next couple of days as well.
And I'm looking forward to having my private screening of the talk someday.
Yeah, of course. Well, at GDC,
yes.
You
know,
like we can go to a Denny's and I can do the talk to you.
We have to bring Zalavir as well, right?
Oh, yeah, that's tradition. Be great.
Love it. And now a whole bunch of people who have no idea who Zalavir is and what the Denny tradition is, I have to Google it. They have to go on Twitter and find out.
Give us a summary for people.
A summary. So there's this a friend of mine, good guy, called Zalavir. He's a, I think his company is called Strange Scaffolding or Strange Scaffold. And he makes a lot of indie games. He's worked on like many, many indie games. He's a brilliant guy. Every time he goes to a conference, he mentions how he does not like Denny's. And now it became a challenge where people will trick him, bait him, rickroll him, and make him find his way to a Denny's. Sometimes multiple times in the same night. Like he's there at like 7 p.m. for dinner.
How could you do that without them knowing? You must know where all the Denny's are by now.
I was involved in one such thing, like literally after hosting the game, Game Developers Choice Awards. We were having a conversation with Zalavir, and unbeknownst to both me and him, the people leading us to the next restaurants took us to a Denny's, but we were so engrossed in the conversation, we only realized when we were at the door. And he objected and stopped, but like we still went in. We have pictures of him being completely dejected.
It's oh, that's hilarious. So
funny. Yeah, it's really funny. The only time he was able to escape it is when he went to a conference in Australia because they literally don't have Denny's.
Well, you know what? I can understand. I'm not a big fan of Denny's.
Oh, neither am I. I mean, it's very plain food. I mean, it's edible, I guess.
But it's edible food at 3 a.m. So
exactly. It's open. It has a very low bar.
It's open and it has food.
Exactly. So yeah, I've had a pretty remarkable week as well, if I can mention.
Yeah, of course.
One of the games I worked on shipped, and
another one.
So about 4 years ago, and for about a year, I worked on Hogwarts Legacy. I was the interim lead of the co-dev team. If you don't know what co-dev team means, it's usually a team that's not part of the main team that's working on the game, but that's doing like that's helping develop the game. So Warner Brothers Games Montreal had a team of about 20 somewhat people who helped with Hogwarts Legacy, and I was like kind of their lead during that time. We developed a lot of content, like we worked on a lot of missions and stuff, and the game came out. And I haven't, keep in mind that I worked on it about 4 years ago for a year. So I haven't seen the game for 3 years.
Yeah.
And so like playing through it last night and seeing what stayed and what changed was an interesting feeling.
I can imagine. The last year of development brings everything together, it feels sometimes.
Exactly. And there were so many things that were literally storyboards the last time I saw them. And now they're like full-fledged interactive cutscenes. And nice. I was floored. Like sometimes they're very different than what I imagined, because probably they changed throughout the production. And sometimes they were exactly how I imagined, even though all I had seen were the storyboards. And I don't think I've ever had this experience before, like not to this degree. Like when I left Warner Brothers with Gotham Knights, I left after beta. At that point, the game was finished, right? Like you're right. Like a lot of things come together in the last year, but like the big points were all there, right?
Yeah.
This was 3 years into a 6 year development. Like more than half the game was not done. So seeing it now is a very interesting feeling. I'm going like it's nostalgic and not at the same time. I'm discovering and not.
Amazing. I'm seeing a lot of positive reviews about the game, actually.
Yeah, apparently it's really, really good. I mean, I'm loving it so far, but I'm very biased.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I'm happy that I didn't know that you worked on it, actually, before today.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't. CoDev has these weird rules where you're not supposed to say... reasons I still don't understand, you're not supposed to say that you're working on a project until your name is actually in the credits. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you know more why that's the case or not. I've never been able to get a straight answer. But it has to do with collaboration between studios and how that's not public. That's not supposed to be public knowledge. But beyond that, I have no idea why.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it depends from studio to studio and company to company how that's handled, actually. I don't think there's like a unified protocol on how that stuff is handled.
That makes sense. But I've worked at two studios that had the same rule.
Yeah.
And so, I'm still not sure why, but we were just told no until the game releases, you're not supposed to say that you worked on it. So,
generally, we try to, I think there's a tendency in industry to try to control as much as possible the messaging around the game because rumors can go wild.
Yeah, that's true.
So, it could be coming in from that, just trying to contain the messaging around the game and all of that. I have a confession to make, actually, about since we're talking about Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I have only seen the first movie. And that's pretty much everything I know about Harry Potter. I feel like there's two holes in my nerd knowledge.
Yes.
And it's Harry Potter and Warhammer.
Oh, interesting.
I never really got into Warhammer. And now as I'm asking friends who are into it, should I? And they're all saying no.
Yeah.
It's too late for you. It's like playing the violin. I'm too old now to play the violin or play gymnastics or anything like this.
That's interesting because my two holes are Doctor Who and Warhammer. So
okay, so now I have three.
Oh, no.
I forgot about Doctor Who.
Yeah, it's I tried. I honestly did. I tried to get into it, and it wasn't for me. And I respect other people who like it. And Warhammer, same as you. Years ago, I'm talking about 25 years ago, we were really young. Me and a friend of mine went to the store with the intention of each buying an army and starting out. And we were so overwhelmed by the choice and the price. It was prohibitive for teens at the time. And we're so this is all we can afford? It was a few tiny units that were just not impressive, and we're looking at the giant ones. No, never mind. We'll come back when we have more money or something. It never worked out.
Yeah.
But I love the idea of it. I really do. I just never got into it.
Yeah, I know. That I will love Warhammer stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's a doubt in my mind. I think it's just I need to be Sherpa'd into it.
Yeah,
and cancel two other of my hobbies
together. Yeah,
it's just one of those things that I think I just watched one or two of them and then I skipped the train. Also, the other day I was talking to a friend of mine and she was telling me about the Fast and Furious movies.
Yes,
and I had no idea that there were 9 of them at this point.
Yes, there are a lot of Fast and Furious.
I only watched the first two.
Yeah, I watched the first two, and I was I kind of liked the first one, didn't really like the second, and I was okay, this series is not for me. And then a friend of mine insisted that I was going to love, I forget which one, the fifth or the sixth one, that it was amazing, it was phenomenal, and I watched it, and I'm no. So that it's just not for me, and that's okay. It's okay not to like a thing that other people really, really like intensely. But I don't get excited by car chases. It's not a thing that I care about. It's just I don't really care for roller coasters. I get that people like that. Thrill seeking is a form of fun that people have. And it's not one that I have. That's all. No biggie.
Yeah.
I tune out when there are car race scenes in movies. I tune out. I start thinking of other things until it stops.
Yeah, it's I get that completely.
Yeah.
I feel I now that the Hogwarts Legacy is out, I might want to do a binge and just watch a bunch of movies that I can get to play the game and appreciate your handiwork.
Thank you, Habibi. So the fun thing is, I had watched the first, like with Nina, with now my wife at the time, I think we were just seeing each other. I had watched the first Harry Potter movie and then like the third and then the fifth, something like that. Yeah. Just like, you know, oh, we have to go. Oh, there's a Harry Potter movie. Okay, fine. Let's just watch it. Like that. We were not super fans. And then when I had kids, I watched the entire series with them start to end. And I had an appreciation for their stories as a result of that, right? Because we watched all the Star Wars together. We watched all the Marvel movies together.
Oh,
we had,
that's nice.
From beginning to end. Exactly. So Harry Potter made it to our list. So at that point, at least I knew who everyone was and what the stories were, because before that, I didn't. And when I started working on Hogwarts Legacy, I rewatched all of the movies and I tried to read the books. And I got halfway through the first one. And everyone keeps saying that the books are much better than the movies, but I think you're supposed to have consume them in the opposite order, because the books were not for me. They just were not.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
It's okay.
You know, maybe I'll start that marathon. I'll tell you how I think by the time I finish that. I don't know how many of those are there, but once I finish all of those movies, I'll maybe get my hands on the game and tell you what I think.
The consensus is skip the prequels.
Okay. Yeah, good. I'll do that. I'll skip those.
I've only watched the first one. It was very meh, but I heard the second one wasn't great either. That's a consensus. You could still watch them if you want. Maybe you'll have a different opinion of them.
That's cool, man. Yeah. I'll give that a go.
Awesome. So anything else you've done this week?
Well, speaking of watching stuff, I watched a movie.
Yes.
I don't know how to describe this movie, really. It's called White Noise on Netflix.
You see, what you have to do is turn it to channel 3, and then you'll be able to watch your actual movie, not just see White Noise.
maybe if I did that, it will make sense of the movie. So, because the movie itself is like an absurdist comedy.
Yes.
But it's also drama at the same time. It's like this mixture of drama comedy.
Huh.
And it's it has this underlying philosophy. So the subject matter of the movie is about the fear of death.
Okay.
And how different people deal with the idea of, fear of death, and what our knowledge as a human race of death propels us to do. And it's done through multiple sequences of events in which the characters speak to each other and sometimes to the movie, it feels, in a very theatrical way. And I don't know how else to describe it. It's very absurdist in the way it is comedic.
But from that description alone, it sounds intriguing and good. So what didn't you like about it?
I don't know if I don't like it. That's the thing. I just think that the absurdity of it, I guess, can come in the way of the enjoyment for what it is. Mm-hmm. The story itself and the underlying themes, I think, are very timely.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the messaging that is trying to get to is interesting. So I think where it fails is that it trods the line of sending out clear signals through its metaphors. Mm-hmm. And losing some of that, being too noisy and losing some of that messaging in its artistry, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so sometimes you go okay, I'm following what you're saying. I get that. And it's no, I completely don't understand what you're trying to do here. So, you kind of bounce back and forth between what the movie is trying to say. I think it's definitely interesting. It's starring Adam Driver.
Yeah, wow.
And Greta Gerwig, and Don Cheadle, I think, is in it as well.
Okay, I need to watch this.
I mean,
I don't know if I like it either, based on your description. But it sounds too intriguing and too different not to watch.
It is definitely artsy fartsy.
Yeah.
So it depends on how you are drawn to that. You might react differently. I have to say, Adam Driver continues to be a phenomenal actor. Despite the hit and miss nature of this movie, I thought his performance was incredible. Yeah, and I think he was nominated for a Golden Globe for this, for his performance in this movie, in fact.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he's. I've seen him, like, you know, do like similar, like not similar, but artsy movie, and like really nail the acting. Like this is one. Marriage Story was another one he did in 2019, which I thought was incredible. With the same director, actually. So White Nose and Marriage Story is the same person directed the movies. Noah Baumbach is his name.
That's awesome. Okay. Yeah. I added it to my list.
Marriage Story, I absolutely recommend. It's not the topic of today's episode, but it's absolutely a very powerful movie. White Nose is a hit and miss, but I think it's still interesting enough to be checked out.
I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Cool.
It has entered my infinite backlog, which will never be completed.
There's so many of them. That's the plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I've watched something as well.
Ooh.
Two somethings, actually.
Two somethings.
Yes. I watched not one, but two Pinocchio movies.
There's more than one? Wait, there's the original Disney movie.
Yes, like, which is not
the older one.
Yes, I've seen that when I was a kid, and I'm not referring to that one.
There's two more other than that?
Two other Pinocchio movies, yes.
Oh, my God.
So I watched, and both of them were semi-recent, like they came out in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
The first is Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
Oh, I saw that. That's on Netflix as well.
Yeah, and the second is Disney's Pinocchio, but not the original. The remake. What? You know, the new trend that they're taking the old like 2D animations,
yes,
and making them live action plus CG.
Like Aladdin and the Lion King.
Yes.
They made them like realistic.
Yeah. I guess. It's like, I just said that they were live action plus CG, but they feel more like CG plus some live action.
Exactly.
Most of the time. Yeah. Especially the Lion King one. The Lion King one was like almost entirely CG, I guess.
Yeah. It's all CG, but like realistic looking CG that I think
exactly
would look realistic in 5 years from now.
Exactly. That's the problem.
That's when they make another realistic one.
Yeah. Exactly. It's part of their business plan. We're going to keep making new ones. So yeah, I saw two Pinocchios. A little before I jump into those, you mentioned the old classic from, I don't know, 1950s, 60s, it was like,
yeah,
the old one.
Something,
I don't know,
like 40s, that.
40s maybe,
back in the day.
Like,
yeah.
Really, really old. That one, have you seen it lately, like recently?
Dude, I remember that from, like, I watched it a bunch as a child, and I remember that movie,
yes,
being very traumatizing.
Yes, exactly. So that's the thing about that movie, is that I had watched it when I was really young, and I had somewhat, I guess, fond memories of it. I don't remember, because when, you know, my kids were younger and we were going through all the old movies to watch, we put that one on and then put it off. We're like, no, not this one. It has really weird scenes in it that I had completely forgotten about.
Very, like, surreal. He turns, yes, into a donkey at some point. And
it's horrifying. And he,
yeah,
turned into a donkey because he's drinking beer and smoking cigarettes at,
yes,
a fair. Like,
yes,
things that you don't show kids that are really young. And I'm like, what is,
I mean,
happening here?
I mean, yeah, it will stop the kids from drinking beer and smoking cigarettes.
I guess. So I'm going to spoil the Disney's Pinocchio a little bit, if that's okay. So, like,
okay,
for the next, you know, minute or two, there might be spoilers if people want to watch it. But as is the trend with all of these Disney's movies, is that they try to stick to the script. It's almost, it's like they're about 90% what the old movies were, and then 10% that they make some changes. So if you're worried about the spoiling of the 10%, maybe don't listen for the next minute. The people, like the kids in this movie, still turn into donkeys, but mostly off camera. And they took off, obviously, the cigarette smoking, and they replaced it with breaking clocks, and they and they removed the beer drinking and they replaced it with drinking root beer. And like, basically that whole scene, which in the first one made sense but was horrifying, was a mistake. In the second one, doesn't make sense, is less horrifying, but leaves you with the feeling of confusion. And the whole movie was that. It was a bunch of interesting little choices to justify old decisions that on their own just don't make sense. It takes you left and then right and then left and then right. And the whole time is like, what is this movie about? I think it lost itself by trying to like, the constraints are too heavy. You know what I mean? Remake this movie, but make it make sense was too much of a job to do. Was it interesting to watch? Yeah, I was glued to the screen because I was very curious about how they interpreted the movie. Had I not had any attachment to the first one, I don't know if this would have been something to watch. Does that make sense to you?
No, it does. I mean, I remember as a kid that I think Pinocchio the movie was the movie I disliked the most.
Yeah.
I don't think, like, you know, I wouldn't want to watch it anymore. It was just it's too disturbing to watch. And like, you know, like, you know, in a lot of Disney movies, something bad happens in the beginning of the movie, like, you know, with Bambi or The Lion King. And I remember as a kid, I used to fast forward through that because like living it once was difficult. Was, and every time I want to watch it again, I'll just skip past the trauma and just get to the happy parts, or like when you become powerful and defeat the enemy.
Yes,
and like course. I remember with Pinocchio, like there was no good parts.
There really were not.
It was just struggle the entire time.
Yeah,
it was like those, like, you know, 70s Japanese animes that I used to watch, and just a kid being traumatized while they're trying to find their mom or something.
Yeah, it's true. And
yeah, I remember hating it as a kid. So like, maybe it's the childhood trauma. When I saw that thing on Disney Plus, I was like, eh, I'll skip that.
Skip that. Yeah. So I don't think you should skip Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, though.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, that one I actually really enjoyed. I don't think you should watch it with children, though. I don't know how often you watch movies with children, Fauzi, but I'm just
saying. Almost never.
So as a general statement to all our listeners, not necessarily just to Fauzi, I'm not saying don't watch Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio with kids. I'm just saying parental advisory. Maybe look up what's in it first and then make your choice based on the age of the kids, because it deals with concepts of death and grieving and war, and it is not your Disney's Pinocchio. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It felt a lot more like a fairy tale, if that makes sense. It was stop motion, so it wasn't 3D. So it had that old feeling to it, even though it was a recent movie. The characters had better motivations. The plot actually made sense. There were a lot of the same beats. I was surprised by how much of the movies were so different from each other and how much were so similar to each other. Like, basically when the other, okay, I'll give you a specific example. Geppetto in Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, he had a son, and his son, very early in the movie, you learn that his son, actually, you see how his son dies. So when I say dark subject matter, I mean, yeah, it's dark.
Yeah, very dark.
And he builds Pinocchio to replace his son, which is more powerful emotionally than in Disney's Pinocchio, who just wants a son and built a son. They're both very powerful, of course, but you see where I'm going. Like, the lines that are drawn in Guillermo del Toro's plot make sense. But there are, if you just describe both movies in three sentences, the two of them will be the same. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's just like, it's just a better built movie in that sense. I would recommend it. I enjoyed it throughout. I was very curious. Again, I'm not sure if I really enjoyed it because I'm very familiar with the Pinocchio story and I wanted to see how different it was. I don't think so. I think it holds up on its own as a very good movie. Very well told, but not for kids, or not for young kids at the very least. Like, teens could easily watch this. Teens watch horror movies, but, like, you know, not 3-4 year olds. The subject matter is too dark. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it's not horror in its nature. It's more drama, right?
Yeah, it's more drama with fairy tales. There's no horror, but there are really, like, there's war. There are people who die.
Okay.
Like, which is not a Disney thing, right?
Yeah. Well, that'll be my movie on the flight back, I reckon.
I reckon, yeah. I think that would be a good fit for a movie on the flight back, especially if you like stop motion. And oh, if you like Guillermo del Toro, like
I like Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, so I think
don't like him as much as Kojima does, but I like him.
I don't think anyone likes him as much as Kojima does.
It's true that.
So did you play anything or watch anything else?
You don't have to talk about it for too long, but I finished Hi-Fi Rush.
Oh, you finished it. Great.
I finished it. Yeah. Oh, that game is so good.
I know. I'm still playing it. Like I've only beaten the second boss, so I'm kind of like, you know, pulling my feet a little bit on the game, but I'm enjoying every minute of it. It's just that there's so much out that I'm playing.
It gets better. It gets better and better, really. Like, you know, if you like every night, you take a couple of hours, you can finish a mission and a half.
Yeah.
Or like if you just do 2 hours every evening, then you like you finish one boss an evening and like you'll be done with it in 10 days to 2 weeks. That's what I did. And holy cow, that game is great. The soundtrack gets better and better.
Really?
I didn't realize there's the Prodigy in this game.
And, really?
And I love that band. And like as I'm playing the game, the Prodigy, like one of the songs I really like called Invaders Must Die, just starts playing. And like it has like a very particular guitar riff. And I'm like super in the moment. Like, you know, that track goes in, I'm super like, and like a bunch of enemies come out, and I'm like, best fight.
That is amazing.
And every time I felt like I've seen everything that the game has to offer, they throw in something interesting.
I can't wait to see more. I've gotten a couple of things spoiled for me because I scrolled on Twitter and someone shared a video of them beating a fight, and then I see like an ability at before I'm supposed to see it or something like that, or co-op partner or whatever it is. Not actual co-op, but you know what I mean, like an assist or something like that I wasn't supposed to see. So I got spoiled a little bit for a few things, but it's not diminishing the enjoyment of living through the experience so far. I'm really loving it. Yeah,
I spent a lot of times in practice modes in which I'm just like, you know, trying to get an infinite juggle.
Yeah,
not an infinite juggle. Like I didn't get an infinite one, but I can get like, you know, really long combo.
Yeah,
it's like you could juggle, get a friend in, help you juggle, then continue on in the air. More attacks.
Yes.
And like once you get that mastery done, doing that to the rhythm is just more icing on the cake.
I totally get that. I'm still shocked by how much I love the combat. Like I'm still early on, but I feel it. Like I don't even need to almost see the screen at some point. I feel it, and I'm like dashing from one character to the next, dodging, knowing when the like everything being synced to the rhythm works so well. It feels like how the Arkham games combat felt when we first played it, but like tuned up to 11. Right, dialed up to 11.
I agree completely.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to spending more time with that game. I actually want to talk about a game I played that you had recommended, but I have to give another disclaimer to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's okay for us to have different opinions about games, even, you know, like, so yeah, I played Tunic, and I am not going to be finishing it. I have very strong yet mixed feelings about this game.
Okay.
I have good and bad. And I am still sitting with the whys of those feelings, so I'm still trying to figure out why, but like I want to tell you a little bit about my experience playing it. So I picked up the game when it first came out, and I played it for a bit, and I felt completely lost. I didn't even get to the first boss, and I'm like, I don't get this. I want to go back to Elden Ring, and I went back to Elden Ring, which wasn't fair to Tunic, and I admitted that it wasn't fair because I had just beaten Elden Ring for the first time, and I wasn't done with it, and then I put down Tunic and went back and beat it a second time. So
nice.
When you had it as one of your game of the years, I'm like, okay, this game deserves a fair shot. I picked it up again.
That wasn't me. I think it was Rami.
Oh, was it Rami? I'm sorry. Yeah. I apologize.
I think I have very similar criticisms to you, actually, but I want to hear where you're going with this.
Okay, so yeah. So I picked it up again. Again, I felt extremely lost all the time. I didn't know if what I was doing was you know, good. I didn't know, like, I felt lost and I didn't know if I was achieving anything. And I get that it's the point of the game. You get an instruction book in the game, you only get a few pages of it, it's in a different language. And as a result, I would look at the book and I'd have to decipher it. And everything was like, I guess it's this. And I would try things, and most of the things I would try would not work. I'm like, okay, I guess I don't have the info. But I never knew. There was never a certainty that something was right. And the game was tough. It was not an easy game. I was fighting. The combat was actually challenging, especially certain enemies. And eventually I powered through it. I went on Twitter. I ranted for a bit. And people were like, give me a few hints. And their hints were like, hug all the walls. And I'm like, hug all the... Okay. And I did. And I'm like, oh, there are invisible shortcuts and walls and connections between the world. That I had no way, like, I don't think I would have ever figured it out, or maybe I would have resorted to hugging all the walls if I kept playing it, but I was more likely to stop playing at that point. But people told me hug all the walls, and I did. And the thing is, I had flashbacks to when I used to play, like, the old Final Fantasy games, and there were hidden chests behind, like, secret passages that were invisible. And yeah. I remember I changed the contrast on my TV at the time to give me hints of where they would be. And that was enough. And even then, it didn't also spell it out, but it gave you a little bit of a hint. The difference here is this was the main progression of the game, hidden behind things that were really impossible to figure out on your own. You just literally had to hug every wall. Some cases, I'm like, oh, there has to be one here because, oh, there wasn't. And in other cases, I'm like, nah, there can't be anything here. And there was. And if you make a thing true, you have, like, if, like, for example, there are invisible walls that can progress the game, then that's how you're telling the player they have to play the game. Play the game by hugging the walls. And that's not a fun experience. Yeah. If you're hiding, like, secrets and, like, extras behind that, I can see that. If you're making that the main progression, I don't agree. I'd like your thoughts on that, but I have other thoughts.
I agree with you on that as well. Like, even hiding secrets as well. You know, one of the things that doesn't resonate well with me from a design point of view is that, like, if you have an agreement with the player on a common language, it's not cool to break it. You know, so like if we agree that, you know, whenever you see this object, this means wall. And then at sometimes this is a wall or this is not. I don't think that's a cool thing to do, you know.
I agree.
And as everybody listens to this podcast knows how much I like Elden Ring. I really disliked that when there was a wall that you need to hit, because what that told me is that basically I was slashing with my sword at every wall I saw.
Yeah, I agree.
And like there were so many trolls that were putting hints that were not true.
Secret ahead.
There were so many liars ahead as well.
Yeah, and, yes, yes.
And it was hard for me. And that, you know, like just that, if it was the one chest or multiple chests, it just created this gameplay dynamic that I don't think served exploration as much as it served experimentation.
Agreed.
Which wasn't like also the positive type of experimentation, which you are testing the system. It's basically you are exhausting all of your options. Exactly. So you're going through all the clouds one by one, or all the doors by one. And so that's the thing. Like for me, there's like almost a contract that a designer would have with the player. If we establish a common language, I need to respect that.
I agree.
Because otherwise I will... that will create a different player behavior.
Well, I'm really happy to hear you say this, because like I feel validated in my thoughts. But it goes to me, it goes even deeper with this game. I'm sorry, did you finish your thought? I didn't want to cut you.
There was just one more thing to add. It's like when we discussed that in the end of the year conversation, I told Rami at the time, it's like I really appreciate what this game is trying to do, but I also think that it was demanding too much of the player. Yeah, and how you're describing it is coming through to me that way.
I agree. Like, so there's another layer to this, but this is my biggest sticking point, is that I feel it works as an art game and less as an experience, like a enjoyable experience for the player.
That's fair.
Because what they're trying to do is rebuild their feelings that they had when they were kids playing a game without understanding the language of the instruction book, and as that. That is powerful. and they mm-hmm. succeeded, because I remember playing games before I spoke English specifically. Even mm-hmm. I spoke Arabic before I spoke French. I spoke French before I spoke English, and all the instruction books were in English. So I specifically remember that experience, and it was not a pleasurable one. It was I powered through it to try to get some good out of the games, but it also helped me learn English much, much faster, because I had a really good motivation to not have that experience anymore. So by recreating that feeling, they succeeded. It's just not a feeling I would like to revisit, if I'm perfectly honest.
I agree. I think
they succeeded in that. The second part is, I actually got upset at one point, really upset, because I beat the first boss before I understood that you could upgrade the power of your weapon and your shield. And it was an infuriatingly difficult fight. Really difficult. And I got to the second boss I almost beat the second boss, still not knowing. Like, I misinterpreted the instruction book that says if you collect these items, then you have more power. And I'm like, really? I don't really feel more powerful. I don't think I'm doing more damage. Is it like 1% more? I don't like, and I kind of convinced myself, no, but I kept rereading that part. No. You had to do this really arbitrary thing that's not explained at all anywhere. And then you use those items as consumables, and then you level up. But what I got so frustrated, I was about to quit the game. I'm like, you know what? Someone else on Twitter told me there's a no damage mode. And I just mm-hmm. turned that on just to beat the second boss. And then eventually, like after beating the third boss, which was not satisfying because at this point I had no damage mode on. And I was like, whatever, I'm just trying to see as much of this game as possible. And the whole time I'm analyzing it, right? What do I like about it? What I don't like about it? Mm-hmm. I got to the point where when I figured out that I could upgrade, I turned off no damage mode. I saw how much damage I was actually doing, and I saw how much needless frustration I put myself through because I didn't interpret this really arbitrary thing in the instruction book. And I'm like, that was when I was like, okay, I can't play this game anymore. I'm done with it. Which is a shame, because the world building was amazing. The game is gorgeous. I actually love the game feel. The atmosphere was great. It really, in so many ways, they captured what made like the old Zelda games, what made them feel special. It's such a hit on some fronts and such a miss on the others that I can understand why some people say they really love this game. But I think it's just not a designer's game. It breaks so many conventions of design in not a good way. Anyway, I have very strong feelings about
this game. I can see that. I can completely relate, man.
Yeah. So like I'm yeah. Anyway, I will stop talking about it.
yeah, it's cool that if you mention it to Rami at some point, hear what he thinks.
I'll tell him to watch this episode that I'm on with my friend.
Let's see if he listens to this episode and he writes you an email about this.
Yes. speaking of emails, do you think we have time for it, or should we wrap up when come back to emails later?
We can do one email.
All right, let's do one.
Okay. If you want to send us emails, where should we send them?
You should send them to info@thehabibis.com. I love receiving emails, and eventually we do read them all. We'll get to
it. Yes.
So this is an email by Raad. He writes, "Hello again, Habibis."
Thunder.
Exactly. Beautiful name, right?
Yeah.
First of all, I wanted to thank you all for this wonderful podcast. You've all become an integral part of my week. Aww. Your wholesome chats and love for each other always has a way of making my week. And as I'm sure it does for others. I love you very much, Rosie. I really do.
I'm really glad
that it shows. So he goes on to say, "I wanted to thank Osama for the great book recommendation last week, Game Dev by Vlad, I can't pronounce his last name, Marhulets, I think. I read the book. I still can't, you know, when you read a book, you can't necessarily pronounce everything in it. It covered a lot of questions I had about indie development and then some. So my question is, what other books would you all recommend, game dev related or otherwise?"
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah. You know, pick three off the top of your head. It doesn't have to be the best or anything, because that's a big ask, right?
Yeah. Game dev or otherwise. There's so many. Okay. There's this book I really like called Range, How Generalists Thrive in a Specialist World. Mm-hmm. I really like this book. I love The Design of Everyday Things.
Yes.
I think that's a wonderful book. I really like Jesse Schell's book, The Art of Game Design, Book of Lenses.
Also very good, yes.
Love Ralph Koester's book,
I said three, and Ralph Koester's was on my list. I'm claiming that one. You can't have it.
You can claim it. Can I add another one?
Go for it.
Eric Zimmerman's Rules of Play.
Damn it. Okay, so out of the three that I was negotiating in my head, they were The Art of Game Design, Rules of Play, and A Theory of Fun. And you said three of them. So I will add one book to that. It's called The Backable. It's not a game dev book per se, but it's a book about making pitches. And I think that's very important to people who work specifically in game design. There is a good book called Game Feel. I don't know if you
Game Feel is great. Swank.
Yes, exactly. It's a really good game design book.
Yeah.
And specifically, recently, I've liked Tabletop Game Design for Video Game Designers because it's extremely topical.
Very specific. I love it.
I love it. It really does cover exactly that specific topic that I was interested in. So it might not be very useful widely, but in the same spirit of game dev, which was very specific to if you're making a 2.5D platformer, it has a lot of specific advice for people who are used to thinking in game design and want to work on non-digital games.
How does
that sound?
That sounds pretty good. I can add two more books to this since we had a lot of books in common.
Go for it.
There's a book called Nonviolent Communication. I highly recommend that. It's it's a really interesting book about how we communicate to each other in a language that is more positive and denounces negativity. And it basically allows you to convince people with your arguments instead of by using the right language.
Awesome. That's great.
And there is there's a book. Let me try to remember what it's called. It's called The Scientific Analysis of Personality. Yes, The Scientific Analysis of Personality by Raymond Cattell.
Awesome.
Which is a collection of scientific studies about what forms people's personalities.
Also extremely useful to game designers. Wow.
I realize that I didn't recommend anything fiction, but I rarely read fiction.
Me too.
I really recommend.
I used to, actually half my bookshelf is fiction from my old life when I used to read a lot of it. But yeah, I've moved away from it for many reasons. Yeah. I'll have one last book recommendation that I'd like to
recommend. Cool. Nice. That's so many.
It's called Friends, Understanding the Power of Our Most Important Relationships. It's by Robin Dunbar, who's famous for the Dunbar number, if you've heard of it.
Yes.
If not, you definitely should read about it. There are excellent white papers that are written about how Dunbar's number relates to game development. And the short version of it is we all have a limit for how many close or, you know, somewhat close or far relationships that we could have. It's almost hard-coded in us, and we could harness that power in our lives and in game dev.
Amazing.
Awesome.
I love that book, actually.
Yes, it's a great book. And I think that's all the time that we have for this week. So in an attempt not to butcher this ending as I did with this outro as I did with the intro, I'm just going to wrap it up by saying thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Salam.
Salam.
That was the Habibis podcast for this week. I'm Osama Dorias, your host for this episode. You can find me on Twitter at Osama Dorias. My fellow Habibis were Rami Ismail, you can find on Twitter at @THA_Rami, and Fauzi Mesmar, who you can find on Twitter at Fauzi Mesmar. Send us your questions, stories, suggestions via info@thehabibis.com. Intro and outro music was provided by Malik Zubayla, and the logo was provided by Ibrahim Hamdi. The Habibis is a weekly podcast about three game developers drinking good era tea, with new episodes launching every Friday, inshallah. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcasting service, or check out thehabibis.com for more information. Thank you for listening, and assalamu alaikum.